Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in Sociology, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Sarah Patterson, and today I will be talking to Jacob Levine, author of Cannabis Discourse, Facts and Opinions in Context. Welcome to the show, Jacob.
Thank you. Hello, Sarah.
Can you go ahead and tell us about yourself?
Yes, definitely. So, as you said, my name is Jacob Levine. As you will hear from my weird accent, I come from Australia, Poland, Sweden. I also lived in Spain. So, and I wrote this book about cannabis, which I'll be glad to discuss with you today.
Yeah, how did this book come about for you?
All right, so first, when I was a bit younger, you know, I got into using recreational cannabis, and after a while I realized that it helped me a lot with my Crohn's disease. So that is sort of how I started getting more interested into the facts of cannabis and everything that this plant can do medicinally. And I started 2 years ago, I started writing for a cannabis company called Zamnesia.com, and they told me to write articles and blogs about cannabis and everything surrounding it. So like the legal status of cannabis, even how to roll joints, different strains of cannabis, and basically all the different topics surrounding it. And it was a very interesting moment for me because I never really wrote professionally before. I never worked with writing before. So there was a lot of learning involved and there are a lot of mistakes that I was making. But after a while, I got a hold of it. So I was doing that for an entire year. I wrote like 50 blogs, articles, plenty of strain descriptions. And then I decided that since I've gathered so much knowledge surrounding cannabis from all the blogs and articles I've read and written, that I just decided to share this knowledge in a way that I wanted to express it. So when you write blogs and articles for other companies, obviously they can edit it at any point. So I just started writing as a guest writer, which I didn't want to put my name under it because obviously the facts can, basically the editor can change all the different facts. So whenever they feel like it. So I just decided to write my own book and write it exactly how I want it. So when I started writing the book, I decided to just write about exactly why cannabis needs to be legalized around the world. So I thought that was a great idea. So I started writing the book saying why it needs to be legalized from all different perspectives, like from a pharmacological perspective, like it's an amazing medicine. There are so many incarceration, the incarceration incarceration rates are very high in terms of people getting going to prison for drugs, which I think is a waste of our taxes and life, really. So I started writing from all these different perspectives, and then I realized that my opinions were quite preachy, as in, like, I was telling people why it is right, and if you're wrong, you're wrong, you know, or if you have a different opinion than me, then you're wrong. So then I realized that I'm not really an expert in medicine. Like, I am not a scientist, so I cannot speak exactly how cannabis affects you from a medicinal standpoint. I'm also not an expert in incarceration rates. I'm not an expert in many different areas. So I thought to myself, maybe that's not the good way to go about it, because I just don't want to be another person who's basically a bullshit artist who just speaks about things that he doesn't know. So then I thought, okay, I'll throw everything that I've written into the garbage, because it's not how I want to present. That's not how I should go about writing this book. So what I did was I started writing this book from an outside perspective about how people discuss cannabis and what's going on in the media space and what are people's different perspectives, opinions, and arguments surrounding cannabis. So I just sort of take a step back and I just explain everything that's going on from today's perspective about cannabis.
Great. So you actually start the book with a lot of definitions. So I was hoping you could set the stage for us regarding all of the important distinctions we need to know for this discussion.
All right. So first, I wanted to figure out how to structure the book. I think that was like one of the hardest part of writing it, because I wanted to take it like step by step and sort of lead the reader into like there needs to be a certain line of understanding. Basically how I decided that the book should evolve was, first I wanted to explain what cannabis actually is. So first I started with the terms to understand, for example, with CBD, THC, different species of cannabis, and I wrote that so that the reader can understand some very basic concepts which are very reoccurring in the cannabis discourse. Then I thought to myself, then I started writing about all the different arguments, different chapters surrounding it, but I realized that the reader might not even know exactly what cannabis is. So I decided to just take the reader step by step, like from seed to consumption, what cannabis is. So first I discuss, in part one, I discuss like what the cannabis seeds are and where you can get them. So you can get them from different seed banks. Seed banks are basically companies that sell cannabis seeds on different websites. For example, like Dutch Passion, Barney's Farm, Philosopher Seeds, Ace Seeds. There are so many different seed banks. Most of them are located in the Netherlands, especially Amsterdam, also in Spain. So you get those seeds from these seed banks. Then I explain exactly let's now take a step back. Before the seeds, we need to understand that different seeds create different kind of cannabis plants. So in the terms to understand, I explain that there are three main types of cannabis species. It's cannabis indica, cannabis sativa, and cannabis ruderalis. So cannabis sativa are very tall plants. It's sort of like very tall cannabis plants. They have fluffy buds that allow them to respire, to breathe more easily. Also, the leaf fingers are quite narrow. So these plants have evolved in the tropical areas where it's very humid and very hot. then and they grow much differently than Cannabis indica. Cannabis indica plants are quite short. They have wide leaf fingers. The buds are very dense, and the plants are very protective by nature. Cannabis ruderalis plants, that's the third species, which was discovered around 100 years ago, or classified 100 years ago. This plant doesn't actually cause any psychoactive effects. However, it is used to create hybrid strains, like hybrid autoflowering strains, which means that the plants don't need diminished, they don't need the diminished sun hours or hours of light in order to start flowering. That's because they evolved in very cold climates where the light was very scarce. So those plants just create flowers automatically, and that's why they're called autoflowering strains. There are three main types of species, and these species are hybridized with each other. So they can create, there are thousands of different strains on the market, for example, like White Widow, Amnesia Haze, Lemon Skunk, Super Skunk, Big Bud. There are so many strange names like Willy Wonka or Skywalker. It gets really funny. But there are thousands of different strains. And these strains can be bought in seed format from the seed banks, which I mentioned before. So, then I'm going to discuss the legality of these seeds later on. So first I discuss how it grows. So during the vegetation stage, you germinate the plants, so they create like a root, then they grow, and they just grow leaves and stems. So it just becomes like a big weed plant, basically. And it takes around, it depends on the strain, it can range between 4 weeks and 3-4 months. After the vegetation stage is finished, the flowering stage begins. So during this stage, the cannabis flowers, they develop, and then the actual buds grow. Buds are the product that we dry and cure to put them in joints or just make various cannabis products from. So after the flowering stage, obviously you harvest the plant. There's a lot, obviously there are so many details in terms of like the vegetation stage and flowering stage. I just want to set out the basics. I'll just continue quickly into the other parts so we have time. You obviously cure the plants, and then you have the final product, which is the dried buds. So after you have the final product, you obviously have, you can create different products from it. So you can create different concentrates, which are usually solvent-based or solventless. There are so many different types of products now, especially after the U.S. started legalizing cannabis. They are very creative in all the different products they create. So the most common concentrate is hash, and it has been used for thousands of years. We also have something like rosin, and you can make cannabutter, so you can just make butter with cannabis. You can make different oils. You can make the carbon dioxide concentrates. So it's basically you use like a supercritical carbon dioxide to extract the desired cannabinoids from the plant. There are a lot of different products. So after the products, I explain all the products or the main products on the main products on the market. I go into the different administration routes. So you can smoke cannabis, which is not the best way of consuming cannabis because you can inhale a lot of toxins. Then you have the vaporizing of cannabis. So when you vaporize cannabis, the cannabis doesn't actually burn. The device, the vaporizing device, actually heats up the cannabis to a point where the desired cannabinoids are released from the plant. And this is a healthier way to consume in comparison with smoking. Another way of consuming cannabis is obviously ingestion. We all know the classic space cakes and different weed brownies that you can find in Amsterdam. That's also another preferred route of consumption because you're not getting in any smoke into the lungs. It's just something that's absorbed into the stomach or into your body through your digestive tract. You also have sublinguals, so you can have tinctures which you put under the tongue and it goes straight into the blood. So it's also a healthier way of consuming, I guess. And it's also more controlled, so you can control the dose more. You can take a specific dose if you need it. It's probably the most preferred consumption route for medicinal, for patients who use cannabis medicinally. And yeah, after that, basically, it goes, I just explained, from the entire route from seed to the consumption. Then I explain more of why people use cannabis in just a very short chapter. And the main uses of cannabis are for spiritual use, medical use, and recreational use. So a lot of people use it, obviously, as for spiritual purposes. Obviously, we know when people smoke, they can get very spiritual, talk about like the metaphysical construct and get do a lot of yoga. There's actually a book called Ganja Yoga, which talks about how people smoke cannabis and do yoga at the same time. And it's a great practice. Also, I talk a little bit about the Rastafarians, you know, that they use it for their spiritual rituals. Then, obviously, for medicinal purposes, we hear it everywhere in the articles, blogs. A lot of people use it for different conditions, like for anxiety, depression, for going through, like helping with symptoms deriving from chemotherapy. For Crohn's disease, which I have, for which I use cannabis medicinally. Then, obviously, we have recreational use. So recreational use, I just defined it as something like smoking cannabis, not for spiritual or medical use. It's basically everything that's outside of that area of use. So it can be just sitting in a park with friends smoking some weed, or just watching some Netflix series and smoking to get more immersed into the series once watching. So yeah, those are like the three main uses of, or like why people use cannabis. Of course, I defined it myself, so it's not like I took the definition from a specific place. I just defined it to make it simpler to understand the book, and also this is how what I believe the division is in use. Okay, so anyway, this is the first part, which takes you through the plant itself and the consumption of cannabis. So once that's covered, now I can go into explaining the history of cannabis. So the reason I am talking about the history of cannabis prohibition is because the reason, like everything we believe in today in terms of the different arguments, the different opinions we have about cannabis derive from, is set in a historical context. So basically I speak about almost 200 years ago, there was a guy called William Brooke O'Shaughnessy. He traveled to India. He was knighted by Queen Victoria, who actually also, I believe she also used cannabis, but I'm not 100% sure. I didn't include that in the book. But she was he was knighted by her. And he was studying hemp very meticulously because he was very impressed by the qualities that cannabis comprises. So he was testing the he made his own cannabis tincture, and he was conducting research with a lot of people, a lot of locals there in India, and he discovered that it's an amazing property that can be used instead of opium. It's very good for rheumatism, for gout, for convulsions. And after he's done all this research, he wrote in an article in 1839, he wrote an article in a medical journal explaining that hemp is just like the best thing, not the best thing, but we should definitely study it further. And based on his article, a lot of cannabis medicines were created and introduced into the Western medical cabinets. Yeah. A lot of people start using them from toothaches, for pain, for convulsions, and they used it in tincture formats. So was a lot of like syrups. Okay, so basically he introduced it. So now the Western society already was acquainted with cannabis. It was very regular for people to use it. Then I explained shortly about the Indian Hemp Drugs Commission. There are a lot of English people back in the day.
Like Prohibition, right?
They sent a commission to India to investigate the matter of hemp, whether it was bad for the society there. And then the conclusion of this 3,500 report, they concluded that that hemp was absolutely, there was no problem with hemp. People didn't go crazy, people were people could go on with their lives. However, if somebody used too much hemp, it could be bad for them. All right, so let's continue to the 20th century. In the beginning of the 20th century, and now I'm moving towards the US, the focus towards the US. Exactly, yes. So this is sort of where the prohibition starts. The Harrison Narcotics Tax Act that took place in 1914, that was passed in the 1914, it was basically set out to prohibit the use, the sales and trade of opium, morphine, heroin, and cocaine. So once that was done, the medical professionals were no longer able to prescribe these drugs to their patients who were addicted to these drugs. So what happened as a result of that, actually a lot of medical professionals went to prison for it, and they just stopped getting involved in prescribing these drugs because they didn't want to lose their licenses. So what happened then is you had thousands, okay, I don't know the actual number, but you had a lot of people who were addicted to very, very addictive substances. And they were no longer able to get it from their doctors. So what happened then? They started seeking these drugs from other sources, and that's how the black market for drugs started in the US. So basically people who were addicted to drugs, they needed to pay more money for these drugs, and they were no longer able to support themselves financially, so they resulted in crime. So like hideous crimes, like murder, a lot of violence. And suddenly the connection between drug use and crime was like, it just went hand in hand in the media. So that's basically the beginning of the war on drugs, because basically the government was just cracking down on people who were committing these violent crimes, and they're just connecting them to drugs, and it was just spiraling out of control. So that's basically the starting point of how we are stigmatizing drugs today and drug users today. As a result of this, during 1919, alcohol was prohibited in the United States. I'm pretty sure it was 1919. I'm not, I can check it later. Alcohol was prohibited. So the prohibition began in the US. So obviously, a lot of different gangs, like we all know the story of Al Capone. There was a lot of bootlegging going on. In 1930, the prohibition of alcohol has ended. And then entered, thus entered Harry Jacob Anslinger. He was the commissioner of the newly established Bureau of Narcotics. So he came into, he started working there, and the alcohol was already allowed. So it was legal to consume, to sell and consume alcohol. So he had a job to do. So he needed to shift. This is my opinion. There's a lot of people who talk about conspiracy theories. I'm not very into that. I just want to talk about what I know. I know that he went into, he became the commissioner, and he no longer had the tasks, or he no longer had the job to incriminate alcohol salesmen and users. So he shifted to other drugs, and the main drug was marijuana. So between 1910 and 1920, there was a Mexican Revolution going on, and a lot of Mexicans escaped Mexico and immigrated into the US, and they brought with them marijuana. Which is included in one of their revolutionary songs, La Cucaracha, which goes like La Cucaracha, La Cucaracha. I don't know the exact lyrics in Spanish, but then there's like, then they include the lyric of marijuana. Maybe I can find the lyrics later and sing it more properly. Anyway, so yeah, so they brought with them marijuana. And what happened then was the media was, also, the blacks were using marijuana for jazz music, or jazz musicians were using a lot of cannabis at the time. So the media was targeting basically the initiative of the Commission of Narcotics was to connect people's racist attitudes at the time towards marijuana. How can I explain it better? People had racist attitudes, and those racist attitudes were used against marijuana so that marijuana could become prohibited so that the commission would have a job. That's at least my opinion. Other people can have other opinions, and I'm open to a discussion about this. So, yeah, racist attitudes. That's basically what kickstarted this entire campaign against marijuana. And it all sort of culminated in this movie called Reefer Madness. It was produced in 1936. It, from today's perspective, this movie is really funny because it's a propaganda movie that just shows basically rich white teenagers that start smoking marijuana, and they go absolutely crazy. Like they start driving recklessly. They kill each other. There's a lot of like schizophrenia going on. The main character Ralph just goes crazy. He kills a guy, and then somebody jumps out the window. It's a really funny movie, but during those times it was very scary. People saw this movie and they're like, oh my God, I don't want my children to be consuming this horrible drug. And this movie was obviously sponsored by the Bureau of Narcotics, because in the introduction of the movie, the person who... He gives like a speech against marijuana, and he mentions a letter from the Commission of Narcotics. So obviously they had a say in what was going on there. So wait, I'm just going to find a part here that from the actual movie. Just give me a second. I'm going to find it here. Just 1 second. All right. So the letter that he reads in the movie goes like this. Recently, a huge supply of heroin was taken. It was concealed in an apparently harmless shipment of 35 barrels of olive oil. The deadly drug was burned in the incinerator of the Bureau of Engraving and Printing. And more vicious, more deadly even than the soul-destroying drugs is the menace of marijuana. No doubt, many of you do not believe that these things do happen, that they cannot happen to you. You may also believe that the facts have been exaggerated. Let me tell you of something that happened right here in our city. And then the movie goes into the plot of the movie. So so this is just an example to show that marijuana was demonized over all drugs. Like, it was the absolutely worst substance that one could. It's basically what we consider bath salts to be today. That's what they thought back in the day about, or that's how they presented marijuana back in the day. So it was very scary for people. 1 year later, the Marijuana Tax Act came into, so there was a hearing, the Marijuana Tax Act hearing, where Harry Anslinger was talking about why cannabis needs to become illegal. He presented many different letters from specialists, I quote unquote specialists, who were talking about, they gave incredibly like horrible stories about cannabis. I can give you a couple of examples here. For example, a case in point is that so this was Dr. Frank Gomila. He was the Commissioner of Public Safety in 1937. So a letter from him was read during the hearing. A case in point is that of a young man, an intelligent high school student, now confined to an institution for the mentally deceased. His experience is entirely the result of acquiring the habit of smoking marijuana cigarettes. There was another one. Another example quoted by him is a young boy who had become addicted to smoking marijuana cigarettes in a fit of frenzy because, as he stated, while still under the marijuana influence, a number of people were trying to cut off his arms and legs, seized an axe and killed his father, mother, two brothers and a sister, wiping out the entire family except himself. So this was presented during the marijuana tax hearing, which is, from today's perspective, it's absolutely insane. But there are so many different stories like this presented through these letters of Anslinger. I think it's very interesting also to mention that Anslinger himself didn't really present these crazy stories. It was through letters of others. So it's almost like he didn't want to be accountable for these stories, but still mediate their message. There's also a lot of like racist indications in the letters that he read during the meeting, such as, "I wish I could show you what a small marijuana cigarette can do to one of our degenerate Spanish-speaking residents. That's why our problem is so great. The greatest percentage of our population is composed of Spanish-speaking persons, most of who are low mentally because of social and racial conditions." So, I mean, there's, you know, it's indisputable that the racist attitudes were used during the hearing in order to make cannabis illegal, or marijuana illegal. And here's the interesting part. They changed the word from cannabis indica to marijuana because people were generally aware of what cannabis indica was, but marijuana was like this other thing. It was like bath salts in comparison to cannabis, you know. It was like something almost like a different plant, even though it is the same plant they're mentioning. So Okay, so after all these crazy stories, okay, I have to mention another story, which is really funny. Harry Anslinger, and a letter that he mentions by somebody else, talks about the story of Marco Polo, right? So Marco Polo, around 1,000 years ago, wrote a story about an old man of the mountain there are people basically who went to this old man to the mountain, and he gave them hash, like a hash drink, and then it sedated them to sleep, and then they woke up in a beautiful garden with foods, drinks, beautiful women, and then they just that was like paradise for them, and then they're put to sleep again, and they woke up in the original place. So then the old man of the mountain said, if you want to experience this paradise again, you will need to murder people for me, basically. And that's the story of the old man of the mountain. So yeah, and the problem with this is obviously that this was a story from like 800 years ago. And this wasn't like a personal account. It was a story of a story. So Marco Polo just heard it from somebody, tell him a story about it. And then it was mentioned 800 years later during a marijuana tax hearing to make cannabis illegal. It's absolutely crazy if you think about it. So anyway, after all these really interesting points of view that Anslinger set forward, marijuana became illegal. So marijuana didn't technically become illegal. It's just you could require a marijuana tax stamp in order to grow cannabis. However, if you applied for a marijuana tax stamp, you would obviously be showing that you are growing cannabis in the first place, which would mean that you would be severely penalized, like even put into prison. So obviously it was just made illegal. Nobody wanted to have anything to do with it. I would be speaking for much less, but I think this is going to take.
Oh, no worries. Actually, because I have a follow-up question, actually, yeah. From sort of thinking about the history of marijuana prohibition in terms of your chapter 6, which you call How to Read Between the Lines. So what did you mean when you said that? And can you tell us about some of those concepts that you bring up?
Of course. So just to finish the history of marijuana prohibition, in 1961, the Single Convention on Narcotic Drugs has been set forward by the UN, which the majority of countries signed, and this is what made cannabis illegal on a worldwide scale. So it started with the US. And then the U.S. had the power to tell basically other countries that they need to sign it. You know, they kind of had to because of the power that U.S. had. And that's what made cannabis illegal all around the world. So that's sort of where I stop. So how to read between the lines. The reason I included this, this chapter is about how to read different cannabis articles and blogs. So how we are being manipulated by both pro and con marijuana advocates in terms of different facts surrounding cannabis. So I'll just take it point by point. So first I explain the confirmation bias. So obviously when we read a lot of articles and blogs about cannabis, we will try to verify our own beliefs about cannabis. So if I think that cannabis is great for cancer, I will type in, why is cannabis great for cancer? And then I'll find a website that shows why is cannabis great for cancer. I'll read it and it sort of like verifies my own beliefs. And that's called the confirmation bias. So that's something we need to look out for whenever reading articles and blogs about cannabis and also other topics. I also explained that headlines are very important because we are just bombarded by different articles and blogs, and we are bombarded by these headlines, and we sort of just read the headlines as if it's facts and we don't read the actual articles. So we base our opinions on that. And it's very important to note that these headlines are exaggerated in order for us to click on these links. So we have very extreme beliefs because of these headlines. And that's why I just go through. I also explain something that's more specific to cannabis. A lot of people don't understand the difference between a treatment and a cure. So a lot of times we speak about cannabis as a treatment for cancer, but it's presented as a cure for cancer. And it doesn't, there's no real data about, no real scientific proof that cannabis actually cures human cancer, like grown inside the body. It's used as a treatment for various symptoms from chemotherapy. But when you mix these things up, then people may use cannabis to heal their cancer, you know, which is not necessarily so. So it's very important to keep that in mind. The next point is the agenda of the company that writes the articles and blogs. So for example, if I'm trying to sell CBD oil and I'm writing an article about CBD, obviously you need to read it from the perspective of that I am trying to sell this product to you. You know, so if you're reading all these facts about CBD, that's amazing and that it cures everything, you know, that's good for cancer, for Crohn's disease. But then I'm trying to sell you the product. And of course, I'm not trying to write anything bad about CBD because my financials depend on you buying the product. That's at least the truth in a lot of cases. And it's the same thing for anti-cannabis websites, like the Drug Free World. They just say why cannabis is horrible for you and why it's the worst drug ever. Obviously, because their website is called A Drug Free World. They want a drug free world. That's why they present it to you. Therefore, you should, everybody should be very cautious of that. And just keep that in mind whenever reading cannabis articles. The next point is scientific research. So a lot of these articles and blogs are written by people who have no idea, who are not scientists, who have not don't know the exact studies that they're quoting, and they often take it out of context. And that's basically how you get all these articles that cannabis cures cancer, research shows. And then you go into different links that shows the research, and it's very complicated, very complex words used in this research. And it's basically these sentences that they take are taken out of context. So that's something to look out for. What else? So simplistic connections, it's, for example, another part that I included there was if somebody says, cannabis increases the levels of dopamine in the brain, dopamine is good for happiness. Therefore, cannabis is good for happiness. It's sort of like it's just connecting things very simplistically so that they make sort of logical sense. It's a valid argument, but it's not necessarily true, because how dopamine functions in the brain is very complex, and a lot of people can actually use it in the reverse and say, marijuana releases a lot of dopamine. A lot of dopamine causes schizophrenia, therefore marijuana causes schizophrenia. And you see this all the time in cannabis articles. Obviously ambiguous terms, so I just go through. A lot of people use words such as allegedly, potentially, it seems like, it's probably like this, research suggests like this, that cannabis is this or that. And that's obviously to take away the responsibility of what one is saying. So one should definitely be careful of that. Obviously, you have You also have disclaimers, you have counter statements. It's all included in the last parts of the chapter of the book. So correlation versus causality, this is something that is very presented very often in Canvas articles, because a lot of times we just say that cannabis causes the violence to drop or the crime rates to drop. However, it could be just a correlation, or that a lot of people who get schizophrenia, a lot of people who have schizophrenia, they smoke cannabis. However, it's not necessarily true that the cannabis causes schizophrenia. It might be just a correlation that people who have schizophrenia just use more cannabis. So that's the correlation versus causality debate, which is very prevalent in the cannabis discourse. I will conclude the how to read between the lines with the statistics part. So various graphs and statistics can be tailor-made. So you can present a graph in such a way and interpret it in such a way that it can show that cannabis is very bad for you, or it's very good for you, and it's very good for our society, for our country, or it's very bad for our country. So I just present an example how one statistic can be twisted in both ways to present why cannabis is good or why cannabis is bad, and why it should be legalized or why it shouldn't be legalized. All right, so that's basically the part. I finished there with the how to read between the lines. Do you have any questions for me in terms of those parts?
Yeah, so I found that chapter to be kind of interesting just from a researcher perspective, right? A lot of things to keep in mind when you're reading research in general. So I really liked that chapter. So then you get into what you call the cannabis discourse. So here you tackle quite a few issues such as addiction, medical marijuana, and legalization. So I was hoping you could briefly talk about those.
Yes, I'll keep it as brief as possible.
No worries.
Okay, so the reason I actually called the book Cannabis Discourse and not like Cannabis Discussions or Cannabis Debates is because the word discourse, it sort of means like a discussion, but it feels more all-encompassing. So it sort of like encompasses, for example, the person who grows marijuana is a part of the discourse, or somebody who's in prison because of using cannabis is a part of the discourse. It just felt like the right word to use to describe this book and this part. So this part, I begin with the gateway drug theory. The gateway drug theory is very interesting because a lot of people think they know what it means, but when you start breaking it down, it's actually quite complicated. So I just explained it from a more simple perspective. It's a lot of people in the media just say, yes, cannabis is definitely a gateway drug, or cannabis is definitely not a gateway drug. So who is right? What does the research say? Well, the problem is that it's how both parties define the gateway drug. So, and technically they're both right. It's just one definition is more, I believe, is more valid than the other. And so I'll explain this shortly. There are three main ways how the gateway drug theory comprises three hypotheses, and that is, I'll explain it here. So it's the predisposition hypothesis, the socio-environmental hypothesis, and the pharmacological hypothesis. The socio-environmental hypothesis basically takes into account the outside factors. So what is it from the outside perspective that made somebody use harder drugs after using cannabis? Because there are obviously a lot of statistics that show that people that do heroin are more likely to have used cannabis before. The problem with this hypothesis is that the drive, the predisposition to use drugs, is not included. So the predisposition hypothesis speaks about the person's inner drive to escalate to drug use and escalate to harder drugs. And I explained a little bit about that, and I just break it down. Then there's the pharmacological hypothesis. And here's the interesting part. If the pharmacological hypothesis is proved to be true, the gateway drug theory will be definitely, the cannabis would definitely be a gateway drug if it's proven. And that's because the pharmacological hypothesis says that cannabis itself causes the escalation to harder drugs. It has nothing to do with the social environmental conditions or the genetic predispositions. That's the cannabis in itself. Of course, this has not been proven. However, there are suggestions that this might be true. So whether cannabis is or is not a gateway drug, we don't know. Yeah, so there's more to this chapter. I think the listeners of this podcast would need to just read it through, and they'll understand exactly point by point what I mean by the gateway drug theory. The main point is that there's more than meets the eye. Then I continue to the next chapter, which is cannabis addiction. So we speak very often about, we talk about how cannabis is addictive psychologically, but it's not addictive physically. Well, I was very interested in that fact, because what does that really mean psychologically and physically? Because obviously the physical affects the psychological. So it's like saying that, you know, if somebody takes heroin, they're physically dependent, but psychological dependence is separated from that. Well, if you have cravings and you have withdrawal symptoms, obviously psychologically you will tend to navigate towards that drug to which one is addicted. So I just break down the cannabis addiction, what people, the main narratives. Basically, cannabis addiction, cannabis use disorder is a thing that has been included in a DSM-5. Which is the diagnostics, I have it here, was the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. It was included there. And so basically the withdrawal symptoms from cannabis have been included, which is interesting because now nobody can say that cannabis is not physically, can cause physical addiction or not addiction, but dependence. It can. However, you know, it's a debatable how strong this dependence is. It's very, it's compared to coffee to coffee. It's not something that is very strong in comparison with opiates or like even cigarettes. Okay, so this chapter is very interesting from a perspective that the gambling disorder was actually included. It was moved to a substance, category of the DSM-5, which basically the reason it was moved from, wait, I have this part here. It was moved. The gambling disorder was moved to the substance-related and addictive disorders part because it mimicked the disorder of the actual substances. So then we can ask ourselves further questions. For example, if gambling is coined like a substance disorder, then what about other behaviors like jumping out of airplanes, or like people who have like a need for adrenaline? What about people who have sex addiction? What about, there's just so many things that one can be addicted to. And it sort of creates a discussion of, it blends the discussion of, it connects the discussion of drugs and different behaviors and how they're not so different from each other. So that's where I conclude the chapter, just something to think about. Then I go through, well, I'm just going to take a sip of my coffee. Okay, adolescent cannabis use. So obviously nobody wants teenagers to smoke weed. And this is true for both pro legalization advocates and anti-legalization advocates. Studies have shown, there's a New Zealand study that have shown that people or teenagers that smoke a lot of cannabis, their IQ can drop up to 8 points, which is a lot. However, they would need to smoke a lot of cannabis in order for this IQ to drop. But again, nobody wants teenagers to be using cannabis. Of course, it's dangerous for the developing brain. At least that's the consensus. I'm not a scientist. I'm just saying what's present in the discourse. So, yeah, I go through just two different, two main ways of countering or like lowering the teenage use of drugs or teenage use of cannabis. And that is the harm reduction route and the deterrence route. So the deterrence route is the classic prohibition, like don't do this. You will, you know, if you smoke cannabis, soon you'll be smoking crack and you'll die, and it's terrible for you. And this has been perpetuated with campaigns such as the DARE campaign and the Just Say No campaign created by Nancy Reagan. And the other way, which is more progressive, which is coming to the surface now, is the harm reduction, perspective on how to reduce cannabis use. And that is to just educate young people exactly what cannabis is, what drugs are in general, not lie to them, just tell them that we care very much and that we don't want them to use these drugs. However, if they use them, if they decide to use them, then they need to take certain, then they need to understand what they're doing. And that's the main way, but that's the main difference between the deterrence and the more harm reduction way of approaching lowering the drug use by teenagers. It's the fact that the deterrence route, it tells teenagers that they have to stay away from drugs. But once they say, if you say no to a teenager, then suddenly if they want to take drugs and they take drugs, well, then there's nothing more to say because they're not supposed to take the drug in the first place. But if you take the harm reduction route, it's more understanding the reality of teenagers, that if we don't want them to take drugs, but if they decide to take drugs, which is very likely, you know, in considering in the consumption rates of drugs today, then they need to take certain steps to be safe. For example, don't drive while drinking, or like if you take MDMA, understand that the dosage of MDMA is crucial. You may overdose from it if you take this and this amount. You know, just educating basically teenagers about it. And there's a whole debate of whether it's good or bad. So I just presented both these perspectives in this chapter. Moving on to medical marijuana. So this is an enormous part. It is obviously today in the US, almost the majority of states have legalized the medicinal use of marijuana. In Canada, Canada has legalized the medicinal and recreational use of marijuana. But anyway, the medical use has been, the medical use of cannabis is very prevalent because cannabis can be used for many different symptoms and many different conditions, like the cancer, schizophrenia, anxiety, PTSD. And I just go through epilepsy as well. And I just break down the conversations that we have in the media in terms of the five most prevalent medical conditions which are connected with cannabis, such as which are basically cancer, PTSD, epilepsy, anxiety, and depression. Since cannabis has shown, or cannabis is presented in the media, that it can be replace many medicines which are used for these conditions, which are very prevalent in the world, it's a very big deal. Also, cannabis is a big deal from a medical perspective because in 1992, we have discovered the endocannabinoid system in our bodies, and and that's a whole chemical signaling system which is sort of like affected and kickstarted by cannabinoids which are present in cannabis. We produce internally endocannabinoids. However, cannabis has cannabinoids which mimic endocannabinoids in our bodies, which means that it can function as a medicine whenever our endocannabinoid levels are low or dysfunctional in some way. Therefore, that's why cannabis is really a huge deal from the medical perspective. Moving on, the chapter about cannabis legalization. So I just go through the fact that in different parts of the world, you have different scheduling systems. It is more in the United Arab Emirates. If you smoke a joint, you could go to prison. You could even get a death sentence if you traffic drugs to there or from there. Whilst in Uruguay, you can smoke weed and nobody cares. It's legal in the country. Well, under certain circumstances, but basically virtually legal. I want to write this chapter because a lot of people just put it black or white, whether it's legal or it's illegal in a country to consume cannabis. Well, there are many different components to legalization of cannabis, which is the cultivation, transportation, sales, and consumption. So, for example, in Amsterdam, you're allowed to sell cannabis, but the cultivation is not even regulated, so it's not legal to grow cannabis, but it's legal to sell it, which is quite weird because, you know, like, how do you grow it and then transport it to the coffee shops in a legal manner? And, for example, in the US, there's a more, it's the states that have legalized cannabis have legalized the cultivation, transportation, and the sales of it. But federally, it's illegal. So it's technically illegal to do so, but the states have legalized it. So it's sort of like, I just give different examples of the differences in those different, in these different aspects of cannabis legalization. What is the next chapter? Let's see. Marijuana. Sorry, yeah, you were going to say.
No, yeah. So I was just hoping here, it's your conclusion chapter. So I was hoping you could just sort of give us the big takeaways that you had after doing all this work.
Okay, perfect. So actually, the conclusion. So basically, I'll tell you a short story. Like, when I was writing this book, it was just like my entire life went into this book. Like, the 1 year of my life just went into doing all the research, making sure that all the chapters are correctly written, that everything makes sense from beginning to end. So it was like, it was quite a journey just to finish this book. Once I finished it, I realized that there's just so many different perspectives of cannabis use. I just started understanding basically, you know, why people don't want cannabis to be legalized, why people want it to be legalized. I just understood it more. I sort of like elevated myself above the cannabis discourse in some way. It's almost like spiritual way of writing this book. I just like sort of viewed everybody in the world that was discussing it, and I gained a lot of perspective from writing this book. So the conclusion of the book is this: I still want cannabis to be legalized and regulated. I still believe in this. So I didn't want to present this point during throughout the book, but this is just, I just shortly mentioned that this is what I believe should be done. I don't know exactly how it should be legalized, how it should be regulated, but I know that that's the right thing. That's the right step to move forward. Okay, so I conclude, the conclusion of the book was a little bit cheap in a way, because like there are so many things to conclude that I just wanted to just say one thing, just something that could conclude the book perfectly. And that conclusion is just the context. The context, that, therefore, this book is called Facts and Opinions in Context. The context of cannabis use and drug use, for example, we can smoke cannabis, which is less dangerous than alcohol, but and we have all the stigma surrounding the consumption of cannabis. But when we, when it comes down to drinking alcohol and drinking a lot of alcohol at different parties or even weddings, you know, then that's not even, that's not stigmatized. I'm not saying it should be. I'm just saying that it's a different context. If, for example, if heroin was clean and if it was legalized and if the dosage was controlled, would it, you know, like there's an entire context of how even opiates are used, that we have stories surrounding drug use, and these stories do not need to be true. We perpetuate these stories by holding on to them without sort of questioning their reality. So so for example, like with drinking, you know, we have just accepted this entire culture of drinking, but culture of smoking marijuana, which causes much less violence. You know, if you go to bars or coffee shops, you'll see this. It's just context, and that's what I'm leaving the book with, just so people understand that the context of drugs are very, are constructed, and this is something that can be reconstructed. So that's, I think, the conclusion.
Yeah, so today we've been talking with Jacob Levine, author of Cannabis Discourse, Facts and Opinions in Context. Thanks so much for being with us today, Jacob.
Thank you very much. It was a very good podcast. I liked it very much. Thank you very much.